Okay, I will be turned. Okay, welcome everyone to the Association of Middle East Children and Youth Studies webinar, digital author series. This is the final one in our series. We are delighted to have you here, and we've been delighted with the series, and we hope you will check them out on our website for any you haven't been to, and you can listen to them. And we also are very much excited and welcome anybody who wants to do an interview in the future. It's a great practice. If you're a grad student, it's a great, even if you're a postgraduate student, it's a great way to get to know a book in depth. And so please just email Dylan or me or the AMC's website, and we'll be happy to find a slot for you to do an interview. Or if you have an article or a book that you would like us to discuss, please also notify us about that. So I will just remind you briefly of the mission of our organization. The Association of Middle East Children and Youth Studies is a private, nonprofit, international association for scholars with an interest in the study of children and youth in the Middle East, North Africa, and their diasporic communities. Through interdisciplinary programs, publications, and services, AMCES promotes innovative scholarship, facilitates global academic exchange, and enhances public understanding about Middle Eastern children in diverse times and places. And now, before I hand it over to Joe, I want to just briefly introduce Joe, who's our interview. Joe Leedy is a PhD candidate in modern Middle Eastern history at Brown University. His dissertation project is a history of youth as a symbol of social and political transformation in 19th and 20th century Mount Lebanon and its environs. He is also a member of AMCES. So with that, I'll turn it over to Joe, and we look forward to this exciting conversation with Dylan. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. It's really exciting to be here. Thank you all for joining us today. As those of you who have been to previous editions of the author series know, we're going to do about a half an hour conversation about Dylan's book, and then we'll open it up to Q&A. So to get us started, Dylan, I wonder if you wouldn't mind just opening up the conversation by talking a little bit about how you got interested in the theme of youth. What drew your attention to youth, and how did you sort of start on the research path that led to your book?
Yeah. Joe, thanks so much for agreeing to interview me. And Heidi, thanks for introducing. And everybody, thank you so much for coming here today. I just wanted to start with a word here is sort of as an academic and a human being, just want to say here in solidarity with the Palestinians, their plights for justice. And I don't know if anybody just saw the statement that came out from the Middle Eastern Studies Association. So things are actively changing, but I just wanted to put that out there before. And also, I don't think we have any colleagues joining us from Lebanon today, but my hearts and thoughts go out to them. As well, given what's going on in Lebanon right now. So with that all said, in terms of your first question and youth, so I'll take you back to when I was working on the dissertation. So I was doing archival research at American University in Beirut. I was actually down in the basement, if anybody has ever been to the basement of Jaffet Library. It's not very inviting, but during the pandemic right now, I feel like I'm really missing it, the surgical lights and all this stuff. I feel like I'm just missing dingy archives more and more. But I was actually, my dissertation was on the history of militias in the Lebanese Civil War. And what I was most in largely the early phases of the war, 1975 to 1976, the Lebanese Civil War, 1975 to 1990. Obviously a lot of the scholarship and political science and history had talked about the presence of these organizations, militias, in the war, and that they were important. But I felt that their early history was extremely underdeveloped if studied at all. What was often done was sort of projecting the violence that they were producing in 1975 to 1960 onto their earlier histories, as if they were always paramilitary, as if they were always violent, whatever it may be. So again, at AUB, studying the history of militias, but their earlier histories, And I found a pamphlet from a group called the Kata'ib, also known as the Falange or the Kata'ib Party, the Lebanese Phalanx Party, but it was an organization in the 1940s. And I found a pamphlet dated from 1940, and it's actually what I start the book with, that quote. And the quote is, "With the youth at our side, there is no doubt we will succeed." And the Kata'ib, I'd always thought of as a paramilitary organization, a political party, but never really a youth organization. It wasn't really framed as such in the literature as such. And the more when I saw that quote, I figured this is sort of the missing angle in my research. I was studying popular politics, I was studying populism, but youth and youth as drivers of the future and youth as sort of the main body of these organizations earlier was something that was really underdeveloped in the dissertation at the time. So at that point, I was doing dissertation field work. It was like, I can't really switch topics here. I'm still kind of focusing on the Lebanese Civil War. But I told myself for the book, I was going to leave off that stuff from the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and really focused on this earlier early history and ask the questions of what were these organizations? How did they become very popular? And then what were their roles in warfare later, but not taking a path-dependent approach, trying as best as possible, studying their earlier histories, their sources, and the richness of those sources during that time period without the specter of the Lebanese Civil War in the background.
Yeah, and since you've led me very easily to this next question that I had, I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about the term you end up using for these sort of organizations before they become sort of pigeonholed as militias. So you call them youth popular organizations. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind sort of explaining a little bit about what that term means, what the sort of historical transformations that that term comes out of, that these organizations kind of grow out of, and what kind of common features these organizations had, despite the fact that some of them hold kind of radically different understandings of national politics in the Middle East. You mentioned Kata'ib, but a number of other organizations are discussed in your book. So yeah, I wondered if you wouldn't mind talking about what is a youth political organization?
Yeah.
Popular organization.
Yes, yes. So first off, with the terminology, I would say that it is most inspired by the work of Jim Gelvin in his book, Divided Loyalties, which he refers to groups in Syria in the interwar period. Well, actually, this is an interwar. This is actually right on the kind of tails of the Great War. He calls them popular associations in Syria. And then also Orit Bashkin, her work, the Other Iraqis. Or the Other Iraq, I think it is actually. But she talks a lot about populism and organizations and social movements. And I would say my kind of positionality to these organizations is most inspired by their work. But these youth popular organizations, they range in form from athletic club to social movement to social club to full-fledged sort of political party. And I'll get to that party kind of aspect later. But what really ties them all together, regardless of ideology, is they were anti-colonial, they were anti-elite, and they were also populist. And I'll talk more a little bit about that. But that's sort of the terminology and the three things that kind of bring them together: anti-elite, anti-colonial, and populist. And in terms of historical transformations that kind of bring about this class of groups, and I study kind of seven from the field, and that's not it's not all of them. Would love to do more research and bring more into the fold, but there are seven organizations that I focus on. In terms of their historical transformation, how they came to be, there's so much we could talk about. I mean, we could talk about, obviously, the trauma associated with the Great War, the famine in Lebanon, and sort of this idea of rebuilding thereafter, French colonialism, that these groups largely came of age, most of them. I think there's only three that didn't. Came of age under colonial rule, under the French colonial mandate. So there's that aspect. But what I focus on most in the introduction, I think is actually most important, is the historical construction in Beirut of the public sphere. Many scholars in popular politics have discussed this. A place for, in my case at least, predominantly young, middle-class men to meet in coffee shops, to meet at universities, wherever they may be, and talk about issues and really position themselves against these bigger historical traumas that they were experiencing, whether the Great War, French colonial rule, or Lebanese elites and their affiliation with French colonial rule and criticizing that. And then also in terms of the public sphere, which was so important for these organizations, was the newspaper. The newspaper as a site, not only to report news objectively, which these organizations rarely ever did, but to practice collective identity and practice group identity and have that newspaper as a space to criticize the state, to criticize French colonial rule. So I think it's one of the biggest, that's the biggest sort of historical transformation I pinpoint, but there's a bunch of others we can talk about. And in terms of what also brings these organizations together, what features, because their ideologies are very disparate, and I can get to that in a second, but what features really bring them together is where this terminology comes from, youth popular organization. They're all organizations, they have some sort of hierarchy to them, but I don't want to pigeonhole them as political parties, because not all of them ever became political parties, nor wanted to be political parties. This term, this fixed term of political party, I think really leads us towards conversations about ideology and platform, as opposed to what these organizations often were sites of youth culture, youth disciplinary action, all of these things that, you know, of course are political, but don't have to do with strict parliamentary and political politics. So I think that's extremely important. The popular aspect, like I said earlier, these groups were populist, but I don't refer to them as populist because I think that's a little bit narrow. But the fact that they, that's actually the first argument of the book, I put out there that these organizations are really significant. And I argue that they're really significant to the history of the modern Middle East because they produce something within the field of popular politics that I refer to as populism. I feel like these groups were extremely integral to this critique of the elites, of the political establishment against their youth, against their people. And this use of the word shab in Arabic, the people, over and over again, discursively sort of practicing that. So that's the populist angle, but we can't forget that these organizations were extremely popular. Not, you know, in the sense of, and like when we think of popular politics, like mass politics. At their heights, groups like the Lebanese People's Party and the Kata'ib had 30,000, 40,000 members in the 40s and 50s. So I think it's really important to think of them as popular. And that how did they become popular is tied to the second argument of the book, which is that they encouraged the political socialization of different types of youth, not just urban middle-class men, but women, rural populations, working class populations, and actually diasporic populations as well. And I know we'll talk about that a little bit more later, but I did want to kind of signpost that a bit. So they were popular and they were youth. The majority of individuals within these organizations were either young people, however we define them, by age, sort of their life stage, whatever that may be. And their leaders, especially when these organizations started, were young. They were in their 20s, they were 30s, and they conceived of themselves as sort of youthful political activity. So it's the reason I also use that term youth a lot. And I think more so than anything, the book is about youth and youth politics and as best as possible, trying to reconstruct how young people sort of fit within these organizations and how these organizations fit within broader conversations of Lebanese politics. And so I've talked a lot about what they are. What they aren't is sectarian ideological political parties, which is often how they've been framed, that it's all about sect, it's all about ideology, and they're always in conflict. As you know by reading the book, Joe, there is a lot of conflict in this book, but I think it's a lot more complex than just anchoring it to the organizations. They coordinated, they worked together, and in many cases their ideological differences did not forestall any sort of potential activity or cross coordinations between organizations.
Yeah, absolutely, thank you. And I think in some ways one of the things that your book does so well is to sort of evoke and describe this feeling of empowerment and self-empowerment, let's call it, of young people in this urban context through a literary kind of, a journalistic public sphere, through organizations. I wonder, and you mentioned as well that these groups are really on the rise, they're really sort of capturing popular anti-colonial feeling in the 30s, 40s. I wonder if you wouldn't mind coming back to that point that you had signposted. So on the one hand, the groups are growing, they are popular and sort of taking on a sort of populist position against elites. On the other hand, they remain kind of socially exclusive in certain ways. So I wondered if you wouldn't mind talking about, as they kind of make this transition from youth organization to, let's say, maybe not a linear transition to political party, but taking on some of the more, some of the aspects of a political party, how do they sort of deal with this contradiction, I guess, between representing the people, but maybe in fact being composed of a relatively narrow sort of slice of the population? Mm-hmm. What kinds of encounters do they have with, let's say, people outside of that slice of the population?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is definitely the conundrum of these organizations. They especially in the 1940s and 1950s. So I've already discussed a little bit about how they started off, predominantly urban, male, middle class. Those categories. But in the 1940s and 50s, they are growing, becoming more diverse, cosmopolitan. There's different words that we can use for that and different words they used for it as well. But that's definitely one way that they're trying to work through this contradiction, incorporate more people into their political mission so they can actually say, we represent the people, which is what they often say, but it's the question of which people, whose people, what type of people, those things. The other way they try to deal with this contradiction is this bigger representation, not just the people as actually membership, but that they represent the people of Lebanon and the image of Lebanon. And that's where the title of the book comes from, this idea of winning Lebanon. I talk about in the book how these organizations are trying to win Lebanon three ways: demographically, symbolically, which is that image kind of making thing, which plays to your question. And then also sort of politically or officially, by sort of gaining the reins of official political power as well. So that's one way they're trying to become bigger and actually make true the claim that they represent the people. But as your question alludes to, contradictions abound, and that's largely what the third chapter of the book is about. It's called Broadening the Base. It was definitely my favorite chapter to write. And it's about how these organizations broaden the base in different ways, but the contradictions that come with it. So for example, their membership across all of these organizations becomes larger with working class populations, not just elite educated men. But often, once these working class populations are brought into the fold, they are often sort of seen as the other in very interesting ways. Like sometimes within the organization, they'll do, they weren't lesser roles, but they would be in like security roles, or they would be playing sports, but they might not be going to the reading groups, for example, things along those lines. So that's one contradiction. As these organizations get bigger and incorporate women into the fold, all the organizational leaders were men, they often, not exclusively, but they often segment these women into particular spaces within the party or within the organization. So that is to say that there might be a space for kind of official political action, which was the space of men, but whether it was getting together for reading groups or talking about issues in the newspaper, for example, like like hygiene or talking about sort of social life, those were deemed as women's issues. So they were sort of cordoned into these spaces by these organizations. So those are a few examples in terms of where these contradictions abound. But another way that they attempted, and this is something that if I had more space in the book, I would definitely play up more, but I think I play up well enough, is one way that they try and deal with these contradictions is by coordinating with other organizations on certain actions, on certain policies, whatever it may be. And I've been thinking about this one aspect of the book that I might look into more so later. In 1944, groups as different as the Lebanese Communist Party and Kataib, which couldn't be more different ideologically, joined in an organization. It was called the Union of Lebanese Parties Resisting Zionism. This was 1944, 4 years before the creation of the State of Israel. And you have groups that eventually are going to be potentially deemed as sort of stooges of Israel, the Kataib, for example, resisting Zionism in 1944. They met at a theater. They put up a policy platform. And I've been thinking about this for multiple reasons, not only because I think it sows this coordination and breaking away from this, these contradictions, perhaps by bringing more organizations to the fold or seeing where you could agree on things, but also showing that, phrases like resisting Zionism they're not new, right? I mean, resisting Zionism in this even predates the creation of the State of Israel. So I think that's also very interesting and something I'd like to explore more too.
Absolutely. Well, I'll just make a sort of sharp transition here, if you don't mind. But I was thinking more about future research and about some of these contradictions that you were just describing the youth popular organizations as dealing with are in some ways like indicative of the same issues we might have as scholars in studying this theme, youth, in, mm-hmm. let's say, the early or mid 20th century in the Middle East. We use the term youth, but there's often a sort of parenthetical, implicit notion that we're really talking about young men, urban, middle class, maybe professional young men for the most part. So I wondered, maybe thinking more about your book, more about your future research, if you wouldn't mind speaking a little bit about the methodological issues that come with this theme of youth, and how you sort of think about the archives that you were dealing with, the ways in which a chapter like the one you were just describing, what kind of work did that take to sort of pull those themes out and contextualize better that sort of notion of youth, which is often kind of covered up in this assumption that we're really talking about young men, again, like yeah. I said. So, yeah, methodologically, how do you sort of think about youth as a category in this mm-hmm. context that you're studying in?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, I'm benefited here by great scholars that work on youth and young people, children, some of which are in this room right now. So I think that's obviously building from great studies on youth, children in the Middle East, and obviously, which is a part of what AMCES is seeking to further. But in terms of how I define youth, I approach it three ways, and I break this down in the introduction, as a lived historical phenomenon, as a category of analysis, and a rite of passage. And I think all three of those are important, and they're overlapping, but they are different. Youth as sort of a term, youth as an idea, this concept that youth could be the drivers of the future, at least in the context of the modern Middle East, is historically constructed in the late 19th, early 20th century. Not to say that these terms weren't used before, but I think it is tied to these changes in the public sphere that I was talking about earlier. So that's the historical phenomenon aspect. A category of analysis, I think we all know that. I don't need to talk too much about that. But I think it's important. Are we talking about age? Are we talking in the context of Lebanon in the early 20th century, youth was sort of conceived as male, urban, and elite. So it wasn't particularly age, but what did that mean from people from rural regions, women, the diaspora, which are questions that I've already kind of addressed a little bit here. But I think the rite of passage, I think, is extremely important. And I think it gets us past that sort of youth as young men. Even talking to these organizations today and members of them, they conceive of themselves as sort of youthful, especially the fringe organizations, those that aren't like really popular today. They, you know, like talking to, members or people who were members of the Vanguard organization, which has been defunct since 1946. When they talk about themselves, I might be talking to 7-year-old men and they're talking about themselves as youthful. So that it's not just tied to age, I think, is extremely important. In terms of sources, I hope that this is one of the larger sort of contributions of the book is the sources that I engage with of these organizations, what I call their cultural production. So this is obviously their newspapers, and 6 out of the 7 groups had newspapers as sites for building collective identity and belonging and youth culture. But pamphlets, dress, songs, I have a little section on songs, which is something I wish I'd developed even more so, but these types of sources. And I think this is where can make some interventions as it relates to the question you're asking about youth is only male and potentially urban. So for example, I think it was in 1946, the Lebanese Communist Party held this host of festivals over the summer, which was reported in their newspaper. And I think I talk about this in chapter 3, actually, the one on broadening the base. And they reported all these festivals from across like different branches of the party. And they were all different. They were all reported differently. Some had like music festivals and were really festive and didn't really say anything about politics. And others were like, we're against imperialism. We're against the elites. And I think that diversity is extremely important while talking about these organizations. I feel like when we think of them often, we think about Beirut. We think about this sort of center to periphery relationship, but these groups and their center branches are really dependent off of the branches for human capital, but also, you know, to build their brand. So I think that that's extremely important in a way that the sources can kind of help through thinking about these organizations and youth a little bit more diversely. And then I think also sources that are great, but I don't have many of them are actually membership cards that are written in. So not like blank applications or things like that, but membership cards that show where the members are actually coming from. So for example, with a group like the Vanguard organization I mentioned earlier, you see that the majority of members in this organization early were young Shia migrants from South Lebanon. And they are being brought into an organization that is literally called Talai, which means vanguard, you know, like the vanguard. We are the youth of the future. So literally being incorporated into that sort of mission. So I think these are ways, but I think for too long, these organizations have just been, just thought about in terms of their ideologies and platforms. But I feel like there's so many, I mean, they have such rich source work. So then the question is, what do we do with those sources?
Absolutely. And I think, I hope stuff keeps coming out because I think there will be a lot to think about. I want to ask a final question here before we open up to the Q&A. In some ways, the end of your book is kind of previewed in some of what we've discussed. You talk about the Civil War in 1958 and about, you know, the era in which the youth popular organizations become known as militias primarily, or become thought of primarily as militias with sectarian ideological sort of bents. I wonder if we could sort of fast forward to the present for a second and skip past, not without acknowledging, but skip past 1958 and the Lebanese Civil War and think about the ways in which youth has re-emerged as a theme in politics, particularly or let's say stood out once more as a theme in Middle Eastern politics after the Arab Spring and the kind of subsequent popular mobilizations that have come in Lebanon, in the region generally. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit whether or not you thought that this is sort of a testament to the staying power of a kind of popular or populist conception of youth, or maybe this is a renewed investment in that notion of youth in Lebanon, in the Middle East in general. How do you sort of see the youth, the popular youth in today's political context?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's fine to skip over 1958. There's two chapters of the book on 1958. Y'all can go home and read them. We could talk more about that definitely during the Q&A if people have sort of questions on the last angle of the book, which I didn't really talk too much about, this idea of the production of sectarian violence in the context of 58. So I can't talk about that. But in terms of connections today, that is definitely another impetus for the book and for the research. I was a graduate student in late 2010, 2011. And I started to realize, for example, these organizations were talking about youth very early in their history. And at least in the United States, and I think we can say this broader to, you know, Western media, however that's sort of defined, it appeared as if this was the first time that young, at least, you know, me watching this stuff and hearing the coverage, it appeared as if this was the first time that youth had been politically engaged, active, on the streets, angry, whatever it may be. And that was just really confusing to me. Because you know, I was trained to be a historian of Middle Eastern studies, and you know, I didn't know as much as I know now, of course, but I had a raised eyebrow. Just like what is going on here with this coverage, and I, of course I think in the context of you mentioned the Arab Spring or the Arab uprisings, we see this young people of different shades, being politically active, challenging sources of power, but also intergenerational stuff, which I think is something that I'd like to develop more so in the research going forward. I think sometimes when we focus so much on youth and young people, we kind of miss these solidarity units between different generations and different political classes and things like that. And that's one reason I kind of deal with that idea of youthful, that's not just young people in the organization, but still I think it's something that could be developed even more so. But fast forwarding a little bit more to 2019, this is something that and then in the Thora, the revolution in Lebanon, which of course is still unfolding right now. This was something that I've been thinking about a lot. And I kind of signal it at the end of the book. We got young people protesting now, we had young people in the past, but I kind of left it there because when the book was in production was really right when the October 17th revolution started. And I was still sort of gathering my thoughts on it. I think, if a question was to be like, what are things you'd like to develop in the book more, if you were to redo it, that would be one thing. Because I think that there is a lot of comparisons that can be made. I think it's an open conversation we can have between 1958 and the October 17th revolution, and I'm just going to state that as sort of not fact, but as sort of a statement for now, and I can get back to what I see those continuities to be across the line. But I think one, and Joe, you were actually talking about this in your Mesa presentation back in October. These debates that are unfolding right now about like what is the role of youth in Lebanon, or do they need, I think you sort of broke it down as like technical experience versus like, popular politics or whatever it may be. And this anxiety about youth, like what is the youth going to do? And this was clear in the context of 1958 as well. There was a lot of anxiety that the main actors that were on the streets in the fighting were young people, not exclusively young men, but mostly young men. And that is where the argument of the book sort of comes out that I'm saying this is the point in Lebanese history where youth as potentially being linked to sectarianism as a bad thing, as a pejorative thing, is where this really unfolds in the context of 1958, because these organizations and their youth are being referred to by other organizations or commentators as punks, as lads, as sort of uncontrollable gangs. This language is starting to be used. And I couldn't I'd be remiss if I didn't mention when the October Revolution started in Beirut, largely in 2019, some of the first people on the street were younger working class men. And I think there was a lot of solidarity around those men to begin, but I actually know a graduate student who's working on sort of how the discourse and language on those early individuals who were on the streets in 2019, how it sort of changed. The term used in 58 for those types of young working class men would have been ralman, which was punks. I forget the term that's used today. Maybe somebody can help me out, like in popular media. But we could talk about that later. But regardless, I think it is this question of who has access to youth as defined, what is permissible political behavior, what is not. And I think we'll all remember in 2019 when the revolution started, it was extremely disruptive. And that was sort of the goal, to disrupt, to partially one of the goals was maybe not the goal was to destroy public property, but that was definitely part of the political practice to say, we are fed up with this. And I think that was very similar to 58, which was known as a revolution by some, then became known as a war by others. So a long way of saying I've been thinking a lot about these continuities, and I want to write more about them because I think there's a lot to connect there. But I think the same debate that I'm working with in 58 in the book more broadly is sort of youth as sites of empowerment, but also youth as sort of been dismissed as too unbridled or too energetic or too potentially powerful is something that still exists today. Maybe the terms of the language and language we use to talk about young people and their political activity has changed, but I think that this tension between the youth of the future being engaged politically, but then also sort of critiques of those same youth and what they should be doing is something we see in Lebanon. And I think we could, you know, even generalize that claim out a little bit more broadly.
Absolutely. I have a brief comment in response to what you were just saying, but I'll say right now, we're going to open up to questions momentarily. So feel free to use the raise hand or just unmute yourself. And I can take down names if we have a few people who want to ask and we can come up with an order, but hopefully won't be too much of an issue. I was just going to say, you were reminding me of this great passage in Andrew Arsene's book, I think was published a few years ago, that describes protests, you know, right in downtown Beirut, and has this very, I would say, almost poetic description of, you know, the student leaders. On the one hand, you have a sort of middle class organized youth presence. They're on social media, they're connected, they're whatever you want to describe that. And then on the other hand, working class youths coming in from the sort of suburban areas of Beirut, or I shouldn't say suburban, not in the American sense, but literally outside of Beirut proper or downtown Beirut. And he talks about this sort of like necessity of both of these groups, that in some ways, this is what made popular action possible, is the sort of confluence of these two. So I think in some ways, youth is such a crucial question when thinking about sort of what makes a revolution, what makes something popular, what makes something representative of the people? How do we even recognize that? A question that, you know, Lebanese ask themselves as much as we scholars ask of them. So in any case, that's just a final concluding thought. Do we have any questions? Does anybody want to ask Dylan anything about his book or about our conversation so far? Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Hi, everyone, and congrats, Dylan, again. I hope you can all hear me because I'm having internet problems. Can you all hear me? Okay, wonderful. So Dylan, Sana, and I are together on the same Zoom window, and we also both of us want to say congrats. So Sana also says congrats. She's with me right now.
Thank you, too. I really appreciate you coming today.
And sorry that we were late, but we had a prior obligation and it's finished. Like everything, unfortunately, what's planned on Zoom usually takes more time than ever. Anyhow, so I'm thinking a lot about, and I thank you again for sharing your volume and your book, your excellent book. And my question is sort of really connecting what you were saying regarding 2019, but I want to take it a bit back and really hear your thoughts on contextualizing the activism of the youth in the period that you study, and how active were they in other temporal frames, right? Like their activism, how did it morph from the period that you studied, thinking about it at the beginning of the Second Civil War, if you want? Because much of what you're saying resonates a lot with the rhetoric that resurfaced in 2019 in terms of the thugs versus those that are disciplined, those that are organized, the types of violence that we're manifesting in the street in terms of how should we think about violence broadly, right? Is it the manifestation of just burning banks, or when are we going to basically pick arms? And that was a very big debate happening for a few months. So my question to you, I'm wondering if you can just share a few thoughts about these key individuals that you study and across these different groups. Where were they in different time periods? Were those individuals as active, if I want to use the word active, in terms of mobilization, the actual fighting? And I know this is not covered in the book, but I know from your work and other publications and work that you're doing in progress that these are debates that you thought. So I'm hoping you can push the temporal boundaries and just share a few thoughts about where they were, how did they morph, evolve? Did they become, if you want, I'm going to use the word, less active? I don't know if that makes sense, but less mobilized. And were they actually fighting? Were they orchestrating the violence? Where is their positionality between the period that you studied and in other parts of the Second Civil War? And I hope we can also open up this discussion to hear some thoughts, because you mentioned 2019, and it's very instrumental to be able to look about how your book is informing these debates, particularly when you think about the same names, if you want, of different parties, different tactics, different forms of mobilization, but there's also commonalities between the period that you study and you've published about and what we are experiencing and living through today. And again, thank you again.
Yes. Thank you, Jeffrey. I really appreciate it. So what I'll start with is in terms of pushing the temporal frame. So I think that was one great thing about the dissertation was this sort of, what is the connective tissue between 58 and 75? What is the connective tissue between youth political activism in the 20s and 30s and the 1970s. So I think that was a great thing about the dissertation. But what I really wanted to do in the book was, and I think you'll understand, acknowledge, and appreciate this, is to really focus on 58 as a moment, and perhaps, you know, kind of the moment and pivot point between those two points as sort of a culmination of the story that I'm talking about. You know, I think it's, so that was one reason that the book sort of ends in 58 as opposed to going further. But in terms of these temporal continuities, I mean, I think it's so extreme. Oh, and the only other thing I wanted to mention is I did, in the conclusion of the dissertation, sort of had a conclusion, which is like, where are these groups now? And I mean, the answer is they're often much less important, much more quote unquote, sectarian or homogenous, and by sectarian I mean like representing sort of one socio-religious group. Often, not all groups sort of get that. And I took that out because I just thought, you know, the reader can connect those dots themselves, and I'll just kind of leave it in this moment of 58. So those are some of the editorial decisions as to why I didn't push that temporal frame that you were talking about. But regardless, at one point I do hint at the end of the book, I think it's a quote from Samir Khalif, a lot of these young individuals, 58 was, I think, what he calls their initiation into militancy. Definitely talking with a lot of the individuals within these organizations that are around today, they were definitely active in the 1970s. Obviously, we're talking about the 1950s. I think that was another great thing about the research, us that know and work on Lebanon, talking about the war and pushing about the war is difficult. It's not impossible, of course. I mean, there's great literature out there on memory and war, and Jeffrey, you know, that's kind of where my research is going. But that was one great thing about kind of focusing on 58. I feel like I could get them to open up and kind of speak about the 1970s when they weren't even really mentioning the 1970s. Many of them were active in the fighting of the 1970s. Many of them either said they were too young in 58 to be politically active then, many of them said, you know, they remember the events of 58. They remember, for example, one great example that didn't get in the book is one of my interlocutors was telling about he remembers taking the buses from Beirut to Damascus when Nasser, Gamal Abdel Nasser, came to Damascus when the UAR was created. So he could remember that, and this was somebody who was active in the Lebanese Civil War era and sort of connecting those dots. So your question also points to a gap. Do I follow these youth and individual sort of stories between the 50s and 70s? And I think the answer, you know, I can't answer that question. The answer to that question is no, I don't follow them directly. But I do obviously follow the organizations, and we know they were all sort of critical active actors in the 1970s. But even though that language of thugs and gangs, and even maybe punks as well, came up in the 1970s, I'd have to look into more so. I think one part of this story is that these youth popular organizations that I talk about, they shed their youthness, if you will. You know, they become political parties, and they really lean into that, adult political parties, even if they are sort of using the energies and human capital of young people. So I think that's sort of an interesting angle. But I end the book with a quote from Kamal Jumblat, because I think it's so interesting. It's from his I Speak for Lebanon, which memoir he wrote in the 1970s, and a series of interviews and things like that. And you can look at the book, but he's just crushing on the youth, and by crushing sort of in a negative way. He's saying, like, we needed their energy, but they, you know, they really disappointed me in the context of the war. I think those who sort of maybe, I mean, obviously Jumblat in the 50s was, you know, probably in his 40s at that point. He was born in 1917. So he was in his 40s at that point. But he and his organization was very youthful in the context of 1958, but in 1975, criticizing those youth while still sort of mobilizing their energy. So that's one sort of temporal connectivity as well. But it's a great question, and one thing I do hope to do in future research is not only connecting 58 to the war and activity thereafter through these sort of bigger tropes, like, okay, what's going on with the Palestinian issue, or what's Syria doing, or, you know, how are these wars different, but also like in terms of individuals and their actual stories from 58 to 75. Thank you for that question. And I hope I answered all of it.
It looks like Jeffrey might have a follow-up. Jeffrey, why don't you go ahead? And then if anybody else has a question, don't hesitate.
This is quite fascinating. And exactly, having this discussion with you, Dylan, I remember when you were presenting the new project, if you want, at MISA, regarding some of the Wahid members that you're looking at in the BSP. I just really appreciated your follow-up in terms of drawing these temporal lines and talking about this disappointment, if you want, which is very strong with the influx of different issues of how we think about the earlier period and some of the vanguards, how they've actually felt that there is this moment of disappointment that you're talking about, which resurfaces also in the 90s and resurfaces a lot in the discourse that's happening right now in terms of the older members that were young. If you ask anyone that participated in the Civil War of 58, and some of them are still around, they would tell you, like, the communal / sectarian undertones that really shaped the discourse about why they're active or not were not as strong as they were in 75, and not as strong as they were even after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So no, I think this is fascinating. I have nothing to follow up on, but just say that it's great that I understand that there's always an editorial decision when it comes to what can be included, what should be removed. They don't want them on these books, but being able to connect them and talk about them is also fascinating, to be able to draw out these connections and maybe not per se follow these individuals, but as much as following the even the evolution of the organization, like the Kata recently has gone through the shift of, right, of renaming themselves, rebranding themselves, and that is having an impact on how they're mobilizing their own youth when it comes to calling themselves part of the opposition, forming these alliances with groups that were in October 17, that were spearheading many of the moves in October 17. But that idea of reinventing themselves also has a lot of basically pushback in how we think about their activism and how it relates to the past. And just the stories coming out of Lebanon yesterday regarding Syrian refugees and voting for Bashar Assad and the role of the Qatar and doing services, it's really scary about youth activism in informal channels, even though we've never, maybe 10 years from now, we'll be able to know that these weren't really informal, spontaneous forms of activism that were really borderline. They were actually racist attitudes towards the Syrians that happened yesterday. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it at a distance, it might be this is another part of orchestrating different movements around these seminal issues that are important for the organization, but also include other voices that are just for sectarian reasons or other factors might be driven to the street. So no, this is fascinating. Thank you so much.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Kitab and sort of their shift today, because I think it's really interesting. I mean, the Kitab as an organization has always had troubles sort of pairing its Lebanese nationalism with its, you know, plights at certain time to say we're populist, we're oppositional. And those were definitely things that were unfolding during the French Mandate as well. So I see some continuities there that we could definitely talk about going forward. But yeah, I appreciate the comments.
Go ahead.
So first of all, congratulations, Dylan. Given this is your pseudo book launch, I want to know if there's anything you haven't been asked that you feel is important to share, whether it's something that summarizes the book that didn't get through, or maybe some idiosyncratic point, like if there's something, you know, you feel you haven't said yet. And then the second question is, in a perfect world, right, if everyone actually or people actually read what we write, who would you want to read this book? Like who, you know, who is the audience that you really want to hear what you're saying?
Yeah, those are great questions. And thank you for I forgot to mention it at the top that, yeah, this you know, and I actually, Jeffrey, who is an editor for his new edited volume, I think it's The Middle East in 1958. Jeffrey, sorry if I got the title wrong there. They did a book launch, like a Zoom book launch. I feel like when my book came out, like that was like I hadn't thought about that yet, and I saw Jeffrey do it, and I was like, that's a great idea. So yes, you all are at the informal book launch. So I think the one thing that I didn't get to talk about too much, which people often ask about, is the title of the, I mean, not the title, the cover of the book, which you know, when you're making a book, you're always kind of thinking about what's going on the cover, and I feel like it's what are you going to title it, and what is going to draw, and this goes to your audience question as well. This painting, which I talk about in the epilogue, was commissioned by, it was created by Khalil Zgheib, who was a Lebanese painter, pretty famous painter. He's what's referred to as a na'if painter, naive or folk painter, which, you know, is a little bit pejorative, but still, I mean, you talk to art critics today and they use that term and kind of, especially Lebanese art critics, and sort of kind of lean into it. He created three or four paintings of 1958, like different sort of imagery. And as this book is as much about youth as it tries to be about popular culture, I thought that it was important to kind of, you know, get some art about 1958 on the cover. And it also, and I talk about this in the epilogue, it really, really plays into these kind of debates about youth at the time period. Because there's some different depictions of youth, actually specifically young men, but also young women. But as it relates to the young male aspect, you have, and again, this was about the 1958 war, the demonstrations. Supposedly the owner of this piece of art told me it was created like 2 days after the journalist Nasib al-Mutni was assassinated, which sort of started the 58 war. War, or was one of the big sort of local sparks for it. And in the top right corner of the, you know, the kind of foreground here, you have the image up. You have a couple young men. One of them has got his fist up. Yeah, there's kind of walking, seems like blocking a street. And then another typical male shababi type is just sort of occupying space and standing there almost idly. And although when I asked people about this piece of art, they were always sort of like, he is a folk artist, don't read into this too much. But I think it really represents these sort of different depictions of youth as sort of agents of change, but also as street nuisances, as sort of idol. All of these different things really, really play into it. And I thought it served as a really great metaphor for the book also, because this book and how it culminates in 58 deals a lot with how these organizations mobilized everyday rituals to understand the conflict, but also kind of to live through the conflict and to practice the conflict and to train for warfare. And we see a lot of everyday practices on this front cover. For example, we see people in the mosque. The tower of that mosque still stands. I think I forget what the name of the mosque is. You have people praying, you have people walking their dogs. While there is obviously demonstrations on the street, there are fires, there are people running, there's a dead body on the street, which is presumably in the Nasib al-Matni. So it kind of gets at these sort of everyday. So I think it works great as a metaphor for the book. And that's one angle by which I would want to sort of push forward kind of popular culture in this era that has nothing to do with these organizations, but more sort of broader stuff. In terms of who I would love to read the book the most is actually just Lebanese of all different shades and all different backgrounds and ages. That because I feel like when I frame my research to a broader audience, I can't act as if these organizations are household names. Maybe some people know Kamal Jumblatt, some people know Pierre Jamil. Like I'm talking about in the United States and like young people today. I mean, many of my students don't know who any of these people are. To Lebanese who lived through the war and around today, these are household names. I have gotten a lot of, I wouldn't say pushback, but a lot of spirited conversation about like, you're referring to these groups as youth popular organizations? I mean, they were sectarian political parties or ideological parties. And I have to push back and say, you know, well, I think that we can see with some nuance. So that is who I want the book to be most read by. Lebanese of all shades, I would love for the book to be translated because I want to have a conversation with, you know, and not just be an AKA or i.e. a Lebanon watcher or an outsider, but in the sense of, okay, how will my book be received in the site of popular politics where, and youth politics where the majority of people have experienced these things, know about these things and whatnot. So that would be the main people that I would want to read the book. So Jeffrey and others in Lebanon, we need to get some copies over there. And I forget who was mentioning this to me at some point. I think it was when I was doing post dissertation book research. Somebody was like, you should do a talk at AUB. And it's like, I would love that because I feel like it would be very spirited. I feel like with many things, there would be some, you know, not issues with the thoroughness of the research, but the framing, the interpretations, and etc. I would love to have those conversations because I feel like they would really enrich the book.
Thanks.
Of course. Thanks for the question, Yao.
Heidi, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, I've been great. Thank you so much. Congratulations, Dylan. Thank you,
Heidi.
Thank you, Joe, for your wonderful interview. And even for those of us who are not specialists in Lebanese politics, this interview was helpful. And this book, or this interview, brought up a lot of broader points that we can relate to about people who study youth, everything from the impact they can have on changing society and the politics to the value in looking at connections between generations of youth to concepts of how we even problematize what is youth and how they make the modern Middle East. So quick question is, what's ahead? What are your future projects?
Yeah. Great. And Heidi, thank you so much for your help along the way. Heidi wrote, read the introduction, and your comments were so integral in reframing it and really of course, we shouldn't take our readers for granted when we're writing, but sometimes with introductions we do because we want to get to the beat. So Heidi, thank you so much for reading through the introduction of the book. So in terms of what's next, it's actually been a project that it comes out of the dissertation and I've been working on now in some form pretty deliberately for about 2 years now. So it is a biographical project, micro history. I can talk about that in a second in terms of what micro history is for non-historians out there, but of a young leftist intellectual in the 1960s who becomes a fighter in the Lebanese Civil War. And his life and the sources that surround him, and for what people don't know about micro history and how it's different than biography, is the book will be, it is a book project. I'm working on an article form right now, but it's a book project for sure. Micro history is very interested in saying, okay, what is the individual, the sources, their locality, their context say about sort of bigger issues in the world at the time, in that context, whatever it may be. His name is Ahmed Nawahid, and Ahmed and his life and his death really speaks to larger issues of coming of age in the 1960s. There's a growing literature on the global 60s and sort of not only youth activism, but all different types of identity politics in the 1960s. There's some great growing research from and on the Middle East about the global 60s, but I think I definitely want to be a part of those conversations. So that's one aspect of his life that really, that it kind of speaks to. Also, youth intellectual production within the Arab left. He was a member of the Lebanese Communist Party. He was translating, he was intervening in debates in the 1960s and 70s. And although there's great literature on the Arab left, on leftist intellectuals, I do think that a conceptualization of youth within that is a place for me to intervene for sure, given my work on youth. So that's one thing. I'm new to the literature on the Arab left, but I think I can, for lack of a better word, youthify it, if you will. And then as he dies in the context of the Lebanese Civil War as a fighter, speaks to broader issues about rank and file fighters within the Lebanese Civil War and following individuals in that war. This is a war that experienced 170,000 casualties, and we know a lot about memory. We know a lot about cultural production thereafter, but I still think we know surprising little about those individuals who actually died in the war, not just those today who can kind of reflect on as civilians or maybe as ex-fighters or still sort of fighters or agitators today. But what can we resuscitate or reconstruct as historians about the lives of individuals that died in the war, but also the contentious battles over their memory today? So exploring the story of Ahmed is a way to intervene in these multiple literatures is the project that I'm working on. I'm so excited about it. It's going to take a lot more research to places that aren't open for research currently. I'll have to talk to our friends in Lebanon right now. That obviously, the situation there is awful. Doing research in Lebanon right now seems pretty difficult. So it will be contingent on shifts in the global pandemic, but obviously hoping that I can do that soon. That's where the work's going to be going. It's almost a return to form, moving back to the 60s and 70s, which the dissertation was on, but what I've learned about youth, young people, and Lebanon from the 1920s and 50s through this book, sort of revamped.
All right. Shall we wrap up? Or are there any final questions or anything before I?
Joe, didn't you say you had one more thing you wanted to say, but you were letting everyone ask their questions first?
Oh no, it was just that brief comment that I already made. Thank you though. All right, thanks Dylan. Thank you for sharing